Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can we learn about our past, present, and future by exploring the most remote places on Earth? Robert Ballard secured his place in the history books in 1985 when he found the long-sought wreckage of the Titanic, the transatlantic ship dubbed unsinkable by the press that struck an iceberg on its maiden voyage across the Atlantic. Ballard and his team went on to explore such storied wrecks as the Bismarck, the Lusitania, and multiple wrecks from the Pacific Theater of World War II. His extensive work in the Black Sea yielded shipwrecks dating back thousands of years. And just last month, he announced he'd found evidence in the region that the flood narratives in the Bible and other ancient religious and cultural texts may, in fact, have been inspired by historic events. Robert Ballard is explorer in residence for National Geographic and director of the Institute for Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. He's in town to speak about his work tonight at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas for a National Geographic Live event. Bob, welcome to Think.
Nice to be here. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. So you made, it was 1969, the first time you went down in a submarine.
In a submarine, not my first time.
Okay. Yeah. What do you remember most vividly about that particular experience?
Well, that first dive sort of spoiled me because I was in a submarine that stayed down for 5 days, and it had 32 windows. And we would, you know, we'd drive around during the day, but then we would literally park the submarine at the bottom of the ocean, and we had bunks and everything. I couldn't sleep. And I remember sitting in this hemispherical forward compartment, just looking out the window. And I remember watching a crab slowly, ever so slowly, walk across the ocean floor. It took him a long time. And it was just the fact that I was there. My spirit was there. And even today's technology, even though I don't physically go as much as I used to go, I have robots that carry my spirit, and I actually think I'm there. And so that's what counts. It's what my spirit thinks. When I look at my hands and move my fingers, I don't see Bob Ballard. I see an amazing robot I'm in. And so, you know, when you move into another robot, it's just a robot's probably better suited for where you are. And so it's really changed technologically, but not spiritually.
I guess it's not so different as the questions that we're starting to ask ourselves about whether we need to send human beings into space, if we need humans on Mars.
You need human spirits on Mars. You don't need human gallbladders on Mars. And we are now in the world of the cloud. I mean, the kids that are in school right now, they look like us, but they're not. They're another creature. And they live in the cloud. And they have no trouble leaving their body and moving their mind. And that's going to become more and more and more pervasive. And you'll be renting robots from Hertz and the Serengeti, and you'll go think you're there. Remember, your brain is encased in a skull, and it's deaf, dumb, and blind without information being fed to it. And then it formulates a sense of presence. You can fool it.
So how do you decide where you want to send your robots?
Well, we have a wonderful group of old sages. I have an advisory board of people I really respect who they can't even remember when they got tenure. That's how sagey they are. They represent people who have been at it for a long, 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 long time, sort of the elders of our tribe. And the elders sit and talk, and we're going to do that in February. And we know we're coming into the Gulf of Mexico. We know we're coming in. We've been over in the Mediterranean and the Black Sea for 20 years. I'm time to go. Mm-hmm. And so I'm moving the Nautilus. I'm going to come into the Gulf of Mexico in June. And we're going to stay there for over two and a half years before we push west into Polynesia. So we're going to sit down. And we had a wonderful gathering of people. And we had about 70 people gather in Miami last month and had 70 presentations, 70 papers presented saying, you know, if I had your ship, I'd do this. And so we've now taken in all those inputs. It was a wonderful gathering because, see, no one owns the data. We stream it. Mm-hmm. And we're breaking all the rules of academia. The data's everybody's. As
opposed to sort of waiting for a big splash.
Sort of sense of ownership. It's my data. You know, I'm going to sit in a dark room and think about it. No, it's in the free marketplace, so you better think fast. And we had all of those people present their case, and they did a wonderful job. And now we're going to sit down and say, okay, where's the low-hanging fruit? Which areas can we get to now? What do we do? And that'll all be decided on February 11th at the Interspace Center at the Graduate School of Oceanography in Rhode Island. And then we'll go. And then we're doing something really cool in June. Think Situation Room. We're calling it the Exploration Room or the ER. Mm-hmm. And starting in June, not only will my ship be coming into the Interspace Center, five other ships. And so we're going to have ships going into the Interspace Center every day of the year. And we're going to have a Situation Room there that will give you an hourly report and we'll take you out to the ships. It's going to be crazy when we get this thing going.
So essentially, if you filled up a room with smart boards or something, everybody could have that experience of being
you
in
can
that
have
place.
It on. I put it on your iPhone. Go to nautiluslive.org. We're not at sea right now, but bookmark it, because once we go, we're going to have the ocean exploration. It'll be called the exploration room, the ER. The exploration room will be, we're just firing up that website. It'll turn on June 15th, and it'll never turn off.
How complicated is it to transport your gear from, say, the Black Sea overland back to the next place it's going to be?
Well, it's on the ship, permanently installed. Mm-hmm. So the ship works its way. So we're right now in Istanbul in a shipyard getting a big sonar put on the bottom of the ship that can make maps, really big sonar that can make sophisticated maps. And then we're going to go and test it. There's a test range off Toulon, France. We're working with French Ifremer to sort of test our sonar and make sure it's working. And then we're going to come across, mapping across the Atlantic Ocean. We come into, probably coming into Galveston sometime in June.
Are there things that you would want to do in the Gulf of Mexico?
Oh, lots of things.
Like what?
Well, you know, they just found a shipwreck, and we're working with a group of archaeologists from NOAA and from the Bureau of Ocean and Energy Management. They found a privateer. And it's an amazing state of preservation because of its copper sheathing and all sorts of artifacts. They'd like us to map that and actually recover some of the artifacts. We're going to be working with ExxonMobil, who are really interested in some of the gas seeps that exist in that area. And other universities, Temple universities, a whole bunch of people. We have a long, long list of people. And we're going to be one after the other, after the other, after the other. And like I say, we'll announce after our website. We have a website, theoceanexplorationtrust.com, and we go there now, but we'll be announcing our schedule in February.
Is there like a Sharks and the Jets kind of feeling when you take the people who are doing archaeology as compared with the people who are doing sort of biology and oceanography?
No, we're equal opportunity explorers. Mm-hmm. We commonly will go looking for something biological and finding something more interesting. We just had that happen. It's not uncommon. But what we do is the ER room, you know, we have what's called a doctor's on call. Just like a hospital. And we have all over the United States teams of scientists that are ready to respond mm-hmm. to a discovery. And we have a biological team, we have a geological team, an archaeological team. So when we go, it's like, you know, when an ambulance pulls up to emergency room, you don't know what's in the back. It could be a mother having a baby, which is a very different response than someone with a gunshot wound or an auto accident or a heart attack. So that's what we do. We have all these different response teams that we can come online. We can deliver. Think about this. If we make a discovery Sunday morning at 10,000 feet of water in total darkness, we'll deliver the best expert in the United States within 30 minutes to that spot because we're going to beam their spirit down there. And that's what it's all about, moving people. Your spirit moves at the speed of light. It's indestructible. And so get ready, buckle up, because you're going to spend most of your future life out of your body.
So is it that ability to transmit information
in high resolution?
Yeah. Is that the thing that's changed your work the most?
And the internet too, the new I2, mm-hmm. which most people aren't aware of. There's a new internet out there called Internet 2 Phase 3, and it's at all the universities, but it's creeping out into the system. And I would venture to say within less than 10 years, I2 will be in your house.
What does that do?
Bandwidth. It's 10 gigabits. It's, you know, you know, how much do you sit and watch your little clock go around?
Yeah, that spinning circle that
everybody
hates.
Or the little hourglass. No, instant, high res. I mean, they just rolled out 4K cameras. 4K cameras, four times high-definition cameras. And these, they're rolling out 100-inch plasma. You're going to have a 100-inch. This year, you're going to have a monitor that's 100 inches diagonal. And if you start then collecting in 4K, you're in the huddle at the football. Look at it now. You're in the huddle right now. I mean, people go to football games, but that's more to yell and scream and drink beer. But most people watch it because they want the answer. How many times you watch football and everyone's looking up at the replay? And they're at the game, and they're looking up at the replay.
Because it looks better on the screen.
Well, they get to see what they can't see, you know, in real time. So, no, the technology is exploding. What people should do is say, where do I want to really live? Go buy that land now. And you're going to – I live when I'm – my typical day at the office goes as follows. Get up, take Emily Rose with a button nose off to school. Kiss her. Have a great day and spend the rest of the day beneath the sea in one of my command centers. Come back, pick up Emily Rose, take her home, and go out on the back porch. Watch the sun go down over the wetlands with my wife and children with a wonderful glass of Chardonnay, and that's my day at the office. I don't have to be there anymore. I go there. Well, it's fun. I mean, I love to horseback ride. You know, my wife's an equestrian, my daughter. We always get on horses. But I don't ride them to work. Mm-hmm. You know, I enjoy horses. I enjoy fishing. I enjoy things. But the job is all about getting the job done. I'm not into diving. I'm into discovering. And I've never discovered anything important with a submarine. I did it all with robots. I found the Titanic with robots. I found the Bismarck with robots. I found hydrothermal vents with robots. Every major discovery I've ever made was with robots. Yeah, I went down with a submarine. Now I don't even have to go down with the robots. Other robots that are better. You know, I have search robots and exploring robots. So no, the key is I'm there. That's the point. People say, well, you know, wow, you take people out of the loop. I did not take people out of the loop. I took their gallbladder out of the loop. I took their kidneys out of the loop. But there, you're there. And if a shark comes by, you could have a heart attack.
Is this a source of debate, Bob, between
Newsweek this week between me and
Jim
Cameron?
Talk about that. Because some people feel like if you really have to be there, it's not the same.
Well, but what's the same? You know, what?
Well, I've never been there at all, so I don't
know. Do you think when I found the Titanic, which was with a robot, I wasn't down there when I found it. That I went, sort of. Yeah. I mean, when we found hydrothermal vents, when we saw the Bismarck and the swastika painted across the deck, I haven't been down there for a long time. And I get tens of thousands of letters from children. They are all about exploration and discovery. You know, and the point is the technology is getting easier and easier to fool you into thinking your gallbladder's there until you go, you know, I got to go to the bathroom. And you get up and there's a bathroom right outside the door. So, no, this is a debate. I'm glad to enter it. I'm confident I'm on the winning side of the debate. And time will tell.
I think it's you and everybody under 30 in the entire world probably feels that way.
Well, the younger generation gets it. They are living mostly out of their body now. They Skype. They get into the cloud. They get it. Older people don't.
My guest is Robert Ballard. He is National Geographic Explorer in Residence and Director of the Institute for Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. He'll be speaking tonight at the Winspear Opera House for a National Geographic Live lecture event. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with the director of the Institute for Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island, Robert Ballard. He is appearing tonight at the Winspear Opera House for a National Geographic Live lecture event. You can find information at attpac.org. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. Bob, how should decisions be made about when you discover what has been an undisturbed wreck site, what is left behind and what is recovered and put on display and sold?
Well, I think, you know, that's a great debate. You have to question who's doing it and why they're doing it. When I found the Titanic, for example, I called the director of the British Museum in England, because this, it's an English story. I called the Smithsonian, director of the Smithsonian, because it's also an American story. And I said to both directors of the British Museum and the Smithsonian, we're going back. Do you want us to recover any of the objects? And they said, well, no, there's nothing to be learned. I mean, they're the same cups that were on the Olympic, and we already have a closet full of those cups. I went to the Titanic Historical Society, who really embody the spirit of the Titanic, and I said, what do you think? They said, no, don't delete it. Just leave it alone. I went to the survivors of the families, and they said, most definitely don't. So I couldn't find anyone that really wanted us to take something. I think that here's what happened. When the question I'm always asked 1,457,000 times, and I've had to answer them 1 million, so I've got a lot of practice at this question. What was it like when you found the Titanic, when you went down there? Well, I'm a 13th generation American, and my family came over from England in 1635, and half the family went to New England, and the other half become rebels. So I was raised, the Ballards have two clans, the New England Ballards and the Virginia Ballards, and we met at Gettysburg. Have you ever been to Gettysburg?
No.
Unbelievable. You go to Gettysburg and the battlefield is still there, and you walk the battlefield. I walked the battlefield with my children, and I came to a little sign that said, high water mark of the Confederacy. And it was the furthest north the Confederate Army advanced in the Union, and I started crying. And I did not plan to cry, but the ground spoke, and that was Pickett's Charge. And my families were on both sides. That's the darkest moment in American history. It was our Civil War. The ground spoke. When I was at Titanic, the ground spoke. It's not about an artifact. You don't go to Gettysburg with a shovel.
Unless you want to make money.
Unless you want to make money. Now, there are cases where we're finding really ancient shipwrecks. We just found a classical shipwreck, 500 BC, with human remains, with all the DNA.
How is that possible?
It's the Black Sea. It's anoxic.
So there's no oxygen destroy.
The ships are preserved. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
No oxygen, so there's no microbes.
Nothing to eat them. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the wood's all there. Everything's there. It's unbelievable. We're continuing our work there. Even though the Nautilus is leaving to come this neck of the woods, we're continuing our work with other vehicles and platforms. So in that case, the archaeologist will say, you know, would you bring up that object? But it's an archaeologist. Okay. He's not going to sell it. He's going to put it on display. But he's going to put it on display in public museums. So it's all about motivation and what are you going to learn. My natural reflexes don't recover anything. Mm-hmm. I'm actually building underwater museums underwater because they're happy down there now. You bring them up and they're not happy.
Yeah, how do you protect an object that has been underwater for 2,500 years?
A lot of work. Take a typical piece of ancient artifact is a terracotta amphora. It's a jar.
A jar.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they carried, you know, olive oil and wine and garum, and they were sort of the 55-gallon drum of the ancient period. But they're terracotta, so they're clay, they're baked clay. And when they go to great depths, the pressure will force the water into the terracotta at the lattice structure. So if you bring it up and let it sit, salt will form, and salt, the crystallization is in a very powerful process. You've seen where ice can split a granite,
you know,
because ice will get down in the crack and expand, and it's very powerful. So the power of crystallization can actually destroy the artifact. So you have to get the salt out. So normally you'll take the terracotta jar and immerse it in fresh water and monitor its pH for months until it's all gone. It comes out through osmotic forces. And then you have to dry it, but you have to dry it very carefully so it doesn't warp. So you have to dry it from the inside and the outside at the same time. It's a very elaborate process. We've gotten very good at it. But then, having done that, you have to take care of it for in perpetuity. Mm-hmm. Do you know how long that is? Long time.
Yeah.
So you now have to be the guardian of this piece of history forever. Wow. Well, it better be an important piece of history to take care of it forever. And that's the real thing that, you know, you're not looking down the line. When Mussolini drained the lakes near Rome to find some Roman ships, and then they were caught on fire and burnt, and they lost. So in many cases, it's safe right where it is.
So if you're not going to take anything up, do you want to document it,
photograph
it, get every single angle?
We can go down with – we have mapping systems now that can create a three-dimensional image of that thing. And we do it all the time. So, no, the technology is there. Yes, in some cases, you know, you'll bring up some objects. A lot of these ships, ancient shipwrecks we're finding, were sort of bulk carriers. It's sort of like a 16-wheeler going along the highway, mm-hmm. you know, carrying, you know, Budweiser. Okay, so how many cans of Budweiser do you have to get out of that truck to know what's in the truck? You don't need all the cans of Budweiser. You need a six-pack. Maybe two. But the point is that you don't – these are bulk carriers. They had thousands of the same thing. Well, I don't need 1,000 of the same thing to figure things out. So, yeah, you can bring up representative samples. But in that case, again, it needs to be done carefully because excavation is a destructive process.
Right.
And so you have to be very careful and have very compelling reasons to alter what you find.
Is there a reason sometimes to wait and leave things simply because there will be 13 generations from now, a Bob Ballard with far better equipment than you
know, in China, the Ming tombs, they excavate one per generation. Hmm. I mean, what patience.
Yeah.
They have the tombs and they haven't opened them. They know where the door is and they haven't gone in. That's patience. So, yeah, I mean, I think, again, what we're doing now is minimal. I mean, our vehicles don't touch anything. If we don't want them to touch. See, they're not cumbersome submarines that are banging into things. Our robots can literally get within centimeters of something and look at it and not touch it. We have that degree of control.
So we've talked about this on the air today, that you are able to sort of work remotely thanks to these robots. That
physically
you're
remotely, not spiritually. I'm there.
Spiritually, you're there. But I think, you know, people who have imagined you on the helm of a ship or, you know, there with a big captain's wheel, which I don't know that they even exist that way. But
well, we have autopilots now, but we can give you a wheel if you want to turn it.
But anyway, my question is this: how much of your work is really about planning and about strategy and about budget and that sort of thing?
Stop right there on budget. Fundraising. That's, mm-hmm. I mean, it's my job. My job is to get my team to see. I need gas money. So that's my job. My job, you know, we're just really coming online. It's been 30 some years that I've been trying to implement this, and we've arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's all about exploring. The technology, yeah, the technology will continue, always will. But the huge step function technologically that we had to get over, we've gotten over now. And we're now beginning a new era where it's more about bottom time. It's all about bottom time. And I don't care. Most of that bottom time is hunting. And you'd be bored silly if you were forced to be in a submarine to do that. Mm-hmm. You'd be bored silly. And you'd spend, you know, when I made 20,000-foot dives, 6 hours to get down, 6 hours to get up. There's nothing left down. I just spent hardly any time at the bottom. With the robots, get them down, leave them down. And by the way, call me when something exciting happens.
How do you use that time? Do you sleep? Do you read a book? What do you do?
Yeah, you sign autographs, you know, and silly stuff, and talk and play John Denver music, Rocky Mountain High. I always played.
But really?
I don't do that anymore. I just don't. It was a wasteful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm more like, so tell me when the robot's down. Mm-hmm. Call me on my cell phone. I'm going in. You know, it's like a doctor. You know, does a doctor stand around while they prep the patient? No. He says, when you need me, call me.
So do you ever come back empty-handed and have to tell
your
funders, sorry, but you've given us $1.4 million?
A lot of Geographic memberships. Yeah, I can remember. I can remember, you know, when I told Geographic I wanted to find the Titanic, they said, oh, you know, okay. Yeah, that's crazy. And then I did it. Mm-hmm. So then when I came back to them and said I want to find the Bismarck, they said, of course, you know, I found the Titanic. Not a problem. Well, I went out the first time for the – I didn't find it. And I can remember we ran out of money. We ran out of time. And we're coming back, and the camera crew producer, you know, sticks a camera in my face and says, so, how do you feel? Well, I was careful on what I said.
We were taught in journalism school never to ask that question.
Yeah, but they still do. And so what did I say? You know what I said? I looked in the camera, and I said, round one to the Bismarck, I know where it isn't. And that's important. You know, negative results – science is full of dead ends,
right.
Okay, negative results. But that doesn't stop you. You say, oh, okay, I know where it isn't. And I said, let me do it again. I'll get it next time. And I did.
Were you blessed without the self-doubt bone?
Oh, amazing self-doubt. Just don't let it take over.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're not questioning yourself and, you know, will I have a little stage fright tonight? Yeah. Have I done it before? Thousands of times. If you don't have stage fright, then you're not human. But it's like a football game, you know. You're always nervous till that first hit, and then you're fine. You know, it's always, as soon as you get going, you're going. But anticipation, yeah. I'd rather not anticipate. I'd rather, oh, here we are, go. Self-doubt is always there. It should be. It's a natural function.
I guess that also drives you to want to do more, right?
What's your passion?
Mm-hmm.
It's all about your passion. It's not, you know, you're tested. You have two tests you have to pass. Did you prepare yourself mentally? That's the easy one. It's the passion of what do you have when you fall down? Will you get up? And your passion gets you up. And so I tell parents never laugh at a child's passion. When I told my parents I wanted to be Captain Nemo, they did not laugh. They may have gone into the other room and said, Houston, we have a problem. But they didn't laugh at my little dream as a child. They said, well, let's work on this a little. Tell me more about Captain Nemo. Yeah, submarine, the Nautilus. And I lived near a submarine base. They took me down. I became a naval officer, served in the Navy for 30 years. They said, well, yeah, but the Nautilus was more than a submarine. Yeah, it had a window. Oh, that sounds like an oceanographer. Again, near my house was Scripps. They took me there. I got a scholarship in high school. I became an oceanographer. So they took my little silly, crazy dream to be Captain Nemo. And let me become Captain Nemo.
To be fair, you didn't say you wanted to be like a circus acrobat or something.
No, no. Well, I mean, so what? That's cool if that's your passion. You know, it's all about your passion. I tell kids, you know, don't chase money. Chase excellence. Money will find it. You know, it's all about being really good at something. And you can't be really good at something unless you love it. And you can't wait to run to do it. And that's your passion. So don't do what people say you should do. Do what your passion wants to do, and don't worry about it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Mark calling from Fort Worth. Hi, Mark.
Greetings. How are you?
Great. Thank you.
Excellent. Dr. Ballard, my family and I saw you last year over at UTA for your lecture.
Super. Well, I'll be doing it again tonight with an update.
Fantastic. And yes, I just got into the car and heard your you talking about it. My 12-year-old had a book signed by, I actually was on the stage getting it signed when they went home, and you said at that time, oh, Mimi, what a great name for an explorer. I went back, told her that, and I mean, she wears that on her sleeve like a badge of honor.
That's great.
And because she does want to be an oceanographer, so it was fantastic. But I was calling to ask about, you said that you make announcements at certain times in order to get the kids' attention and
correct.
To bring them in. If we had a school, like a public school, mm-hmm. and they didn't have that kind of equipment, is there a way through educational?
No, all they need is a laptop. I mean, they got to have a laptop. They got to have internet. One, I'm sure your school has internet.
So let's bring Mark back on.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, all you need is a laptop and go to either nautiluslive.org, and you're in the game. I mean, do it from your home. You can do it from your iPhone. I can't believe that you can't see us live starting in June. I'd be shocked.
All right, Mark, thank you so much for your call. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Bill wants to know if tonight's event will be streamed.
I don't know if it will. I don't know. It might. But if you want to see, go to my TED conference talk, which was 17 minutes long. Go mm-hmm. to Robert Ballard TED conference, and you'll see one I did recently.
Did you? Is it daunting to come up with a TED speech because they're supposed to be the be-all and end-all of everything, and people pay $6,000?
Yeah, that is sort of the Olympics of speaking. And it's 17 minutes, and you're standing on a trap door, and it will go. and so it's a challenge. It's fun. You see the best of the best mm-hmm. at performing and presenting. It's cool. And the nice thing, you can get it now. You don't have to pay the $6,000 if you want to watch it the first time.
Yeah.
Go on the web.
Yeah, those are actually
my son
great.
Watches lots of TED talks. Mm-hmm. He loves them because they're 17 minutes long. They're the format of the young person. Quick. And sweet.
How interested are your kids in what you do? Not that they want to do the same thing, but I wonder
They go to see with me. Yeah. But they, my son calls it the family business, but that's not his passion.
Mm-hmm.
And I know it's not his passion. He's humoring his father. He likes to be with his father. He likes to see me in my zone. Mm-hmm. As he says, he likes to go to sea because he has a classic love of the sea and sailing. He's a great sailor. He also is a classicist. He loves the classics. But is he going to become an oceanographer? No. My daughter is an equestrian, but her real passion is video production, which we do a lot. My wife's a video producer, so it's the gene. The fruit does not fall far from the tree. My daughter's going to be going with me for the first time because she hit the magic age of 15, which is what the insurance companies insist upon. So, no, they're going to do their dream, and they're going to follow their passion, and I'm going to enjoy it.
Robert Ballard is with us. He's National Geographic Explorer in Residence, and he directs the Institute for Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. He's in town to speak tonight at the Winspear Opera House for a National Geographic live lecture event. Find information at attpac.org. If you want to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. New spring semester personal enrichment and professional development courses are now open and available for registration. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with National Geographic Explorer in Residence Robert Ballard, who is in town to appear tonight at the Winspear Opera House in Dallas for a National Geographic Live lecture event. Learn more at attpac.org. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. Before we go any further, we have lots of people who want to talk to you on the phone. I want to talk about your search for evidence of some kind of cataclysmic flood.
Correct.
In
the Black Sea.
Yeah. Talk about what you discovered and how you put together all the different pieces of evidence you found to make this conclusion.
Well, first, you do your homework. And the first is to read the book Noah's Flood by Walter Pittman and Bill Ryan. These are oceanographers. These are scholars. These are not people that are, off in left field. And they wrote this amazing book that I read about the flooding of the Black Sea. See, we know that the Black Sea flooded, but we didn't know when, we didn't know how, blah, blah, blah.
So it was fresh water, and then it was flooded with salt water.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was during the Ice Age, the Wisconsin, during, about 12,000 years ago, go to the last great ice advance called the Wisconsin Ice Advance. there was a lot of water that should have been in the ocean that was caught in the glaciers, like 15 million cubic kilometers of ice.
Wow.
So we had a big...
How much space is that, 15 million cubic kilometers?
A lot.
Okay,
a lot. And so that big ice cube that was spread across our land masses came out of the ocean. So the ocean lost and it went down.
Right.
So 12,000 years ago, where I live in New England, on the shore, if I wanted to go to the shore, then I had to drive 100 miles to get to the shoreline across the what's called the continental shelf. So the continental shelf was land. And Native Americans, everyone was living out there, okay, just like they live near the ocean now. So that's cool, and everyone's living long. And then the ice starts to melt. Well, it melts, and it goes and comes. But there were all sorts of – if you look at most cultures, they have flood stories. Because here's what happens.
The Epic of Gilgamesh, right, and then the Bible.
Well, Native Americans, everyone's got a flood story. Why? Because they were – here's what happens. Take the Hudson River, okay. Imagine a glacier sitting right at New York City. Okay, right in Manhattan. And that glacier, as it was coming down the Hudson, was like a bulldozer.
Mm-hmm.
And it pushed in front of it a mountain of gravel and sand and everything. Then it retreated. It had dropped it. So it formed a giant dam. So the initial meltwater in a lot of these rivers didn't get out right away because there was this dam in front of them. So behind that grew a gigantic lake called Lake Albany, and it took up most of New York and into New England. It's a giant bucket of water. The dam went, and anyone downstream had a bad day, and that led to stories. So all over the world, the dams were breaking. Everyone was experiencing dam breakage and floods, but in the Black Sea was the mother of all floods because it was a huge depression that didn't fill. Okay, the glaciers blocked the water from the Russian rivers and the Danube from coming. So that Black Sea shoreline stayed down while the rest of the world rose because the oceans are all connected. We call them the Atlantic Ocean, the Pacific Ocean. They're all connected. You know, they're this one big bucket of water. And even into the Mediterranean through the Straits of Gibraltar. So that whole thing is rising, but not in the Black Sea. And it comes right to the very door, which is at the Bosporus. And that dam broke. And the water came shooting in like a cannon. And there were people living all 150,000 square kilometers of land went under. Now, where does the Bible put the story? Mount Ararat. Where is that same place? Okay. So here's the point. So we wanted to go in and see if we could find the ancient shoreline that existed before the flood. And we did. We found it at 155 meters under the ocean. And we saw a shoreline. And we went along the shoreline. We picked up shells from the shoreline. And all sorts of shells. We went to send them out to the carbon-14 lab and said, here's 50 shells. Tell me how old they are. And they can do carbon-14. Well, you got a shell that's 15,000 years old. You got one that's 14. You got 12. You got 10. All the way up to 5,000-year-old shell. So I had shells that spanned 10,000 years of history.
They build up over time.
Mm-hmm. And they're all just there. And so then I said to experts who didn't know about their ages, I said, I got 20 shells. Can you tell me what kind of shells I have? And they said, yep. These are freshwater shells, and these are saltwater creatures, shells, mollusks. And I then combined the data, and guess what? All of the old shells were freshwater creatures up to a spot in time at 7,500 BP before the present. And then everything was salt after that. And so that was the moment. Now, that's about 5,000 BC. You know, we use BP before present because not everyone in the world is Christians, okay? Or before the common era is common use now. But so we saw the moment when it happened, which conformed with Walter Pittman and Bill Ryan were suggesting, that there was a sudden inundation. And then, unlike most floods, the land didn't come back. We lost it. So that's a big flood. It's one thing to have a flood and go back to your insurance company and build again in the wetlands. And why do they call it the wetlands or the flood plain? Because they're going to flood. Okay. But we go back. We're doing it right now in New York. We're, after Sandy, we're rebuilding. And guess what? We're going to get hit again. But in the Black Sea, it didn't come back. So these people had to leave. The ones that survived had to give up their homeland. This is a big story. And that story was carried on in oral histories until someone wrote it now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We'll go back to the phones now. This time we have Robert on the line in Dallas. Hey, Robert.
Hello.
Hi.
Dr. Ballard, thanks for being a great explorer and bringing all these things into our generations to come. I guess my question is, you talked earlier about some of the financial responsibility you have as kind of a senior executive leading the mission. Can you talk about, do these ships typically cost $5 to $10 million to put out to sea? You talked about refitting sonar equipment.
No, I can tell you the math. I know it. I live on a spreadsheet. If you look at our ship, we run very economically. We run our ship full up with everything on it at about $35,000 a day. Our total operating budget for a season is like $6 million. That's peanuts in space exploration. That's peanuts even in ocean exploration. So this is not a big number, but I got to raise it. And I raise half of it from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Ocean Exploration Program. And I run the other half through our outreach from National Geographic, television shows we do, museums that take our live broadcast, schools. So 50% of my income is coming from my outreach programs, and 50% is coming from the fundamental exploration itself.
When you find a bright young person to sign on to the crew, is it your hope that they'll stay with you for 20 years, or mm-hmm. is it your hope that they will? It is.
I go after them. I recruit a lot of my team when they're 12. No, really. I've got several members on my team I recruited when they were 12.
Really? You went to schools and talked to them?
Yeah, they were Jason Argonauts, and I was impressed. We have a Jason called the Jason Project.
Yeah.
And a lot of people in Texas know all about the Jason Project, and it was EDS. Actually, it all began at SMU at a lecture.
There you go.
So I hear they're your sponsor. I gave a talk at SMU, when was it, 1980? I'm reaching back, 87, I think it was. And there was a guy in the audience, Jim Young from EDS, who said, I think we can help y'all with your vision. And from that came the Jason Project with Les Aberthal and EDS, and there's a lot of EDSers out there. And they shared my dream. So, yeah, it's really the technology was just emerging. And now, my gosh, when you look at what we got, it's amazing technology.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Email address is think@kera.org. Joel writes, I've heard it said that humans have explored a very small percentage of the Earth's oceans. What sort of new discoveries can we make by exploring the oceans more thoroughly?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because the honest answer to it is I have no idea what we're going to find.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I went after the Titanic, obviously if I found it was the Titanic, but that was not a discovery. That was missing something you went to lost and found. But the discovery of new life forms, the discovery of mineral deposits, discovery of things, we didn't know they were there. I mean, the real thrill is when you're sitting there going, what's that? And you don't know. When we found those 10-foot tube worms, we had a ship full of PhDs, and for the first time they were silent because they didn't understand what they were looking at, and they just went,
And then after that silence, do people get sort of giddy?
Oh, yeah, because then they figured it out, and they went, wow, this is significant. So my greatest discovery is the one I'm about to make, and I don't know what it is.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Donna in Farmers Branch. Hi, Donna.
Well, hi. Thank you for your wonderful program and such a revelation. I was not aware of Mr. Ballard's work, but it's so amazing. Thank you first for answering the question regarding the discovery of evidence of flood. But I can't help but be impressed by your spirit, your Emily Rose with a button nose, and just everything whimsical. And is there an underlying philosophy or religious inspiration that brings forth your passion and your work?
Well, my guru was Joseph Campbell. And I don't know if you've ever read The Power of Myth, but that's really encapsulates my spirit. So if you really want to read a great book, certainly one that had a lot of influence on mine, listen to his lectures. He was a great studier of comparative religions, and he was a great, great mind that I miss.
What sources do you go to keep up with the work that other people in your business are doing? And, I mean, I would imagine the volume of scientific knowledge is growing so fast, it's hard to read it all, to keep up with it all.
I probably Google 100 times a day. Mm-hmm. I'm just in what's really wonderful now. I remember when you go to the encyclopedia, okay, and I spend all my time in the index as opposed to reading the information. It's amazing what's at our fingertips right now. And I Google and I Google and I Google. I just am a sponge for information. But I'm also running with a young crowd. You know, I'm 70.
Which is astonishing. I know that from your bio, but it's astonishing to sit here across from you.
Well, I never grew up. I really worked hard to keep that child alive inside of me. And we're all born with a flame of curiosity. The first question a child is, why? And then you answer, and they say, but why? After four but whys, they've taken you through the total knowledge base of the human race. So the key is don't discourage the questioning. And a lot of what we try to do with our teachers, and we say, look, teachers are very uncomfortable when they don't know the answer. We say we embrace that we don't know. We're on a journey of discovery. Why are we here? It's because we don't know. So embrace I don't know, but let's find out. And it is determinate. I've come to conclude that the world has a pattern. There is sameness in it all. It is determinate. You just have to figure it out. It's a Rubik's Cube. And so it's a journey of exploration and discovery. And if you look at literature, and I love literature as well, and Odysseus and the Odyssey, it's all about what's called the epic journey. And the epic journey begins with a dream that you have to do something, to be something. That's your passion talking to you. When you dream, it's your passion talking to you. And then you say, okay, I'm going to go in pursuit of this, but first I have to get ready. And that's what's called school. You go to school to get ready to live your passion, and that's your preparatory phase. Then you go out on your journey, and you're tested. I mean, you've got to be tested. The tests are important because failure is a great teacher. The greatest teacher you're ever going to meet is failure. So you're tested, and you're tested in your mind. How well have you prepared yourself? And that turns out to be the easiest test because you can prepare yourself. But it's the test of your heart, the test of your passion that you have to pass. Because you're going to meet failure. You're going to get knocked down. It's not an easy road. You people that are in failure avoidance are in success avoidance because you must pass through failure to success. You don't get around it. You have to embrace it and work your way through it. You know, I say, bad day, the sun will come out, just keep rowing. And sometimes it's really bad. I had a little grandson from Newtown, a 7-year-old. We've been through some pretty tough times the last few weeks. It's been very tough. Because my family lives in Newtown, Connecticut. And I'll just have to stop there.
Robert Ballard is National Geographic Explorer in Residence and Director of the Institute for Archaeological Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. He is here to speak at the Winspear Opera House tonight for a National Geographic Live lecture event. Bob, thank you so much for being with us. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Knavy. We had Joe Bilotti on the phones. Christine McConnell produces our podcast. Jeff Whittington is our senior producer. You can learn more about the show, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. Email think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.